Hello, my name is Kingham Abbott.
Hello.
I haven't spoken to a microphone in quite a long time. I'm just getting over the shock of hearing that.
I don't know where to begin. I sort of want to begin in the middle, and then go to the end, and then go to the beginning, and then back to the end again. So, so on this day, or yesterday, 6 years ago, I moved to America, and I had quite a journey when I was there. And shortly before, the last show that I had done in England, was in England, was here, just before I left. And it was such a wonderful night for me, and I shared, and people actually laughed at what I said, and I felt vaguely popular for like the first time in my life. It was a really nice feeling, and I was tempted to listen to that share and just, you know, pull out all of the best jokes and use them again, but I didn't do that, and so I'm just going to kind of try something different, because I've changed, and my story has changed, and I think that's what's meant to happen. So I'm going to actually share that. So I think, you know, the standard format for a share was, you know, I was a lonely misfit and didn't have any friends, and I took drugs and everything was awful, and I messed everything up, and then I came to NA and everything, you know, worked out, and I'm a happy person, and, you know. So I think that's a standard format of what I'm meant to do with, you know, elaborating on the details that happened along the way. But I've had quite a lot of life on life's terms, and I think it is important to share that. There are some people that think that obscures the message and frightens the newcomers, but, you know, I really wish that somebody would have told me that recovery offers a bridge to normal living, and life can be messy and complicated, and, you know, with recovery, you can sort of get through it. And, you know, that's what I'd learned. That's really what I learned, and so I'm going to talk about that a lot. So, I don't know. I did a show the other day. I think I nearly made it through the entire show without talking about having taken drugs. So, I had to write a note to remind myself to qualify. So when I got here, I looked a lot different. I think my hair was about an inch long, and it was bright red. I had lots of, you know, metal in my face and visible tattoos and all of that sort of thing, and really thought of myself much differently than I think of myself now. I was, you know, I didn't come here on a winning streak. You know, I didn't get here because I necessarily wanted to be here. But on March 23rd of 2000, I went to my very first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, my life was a mess. I wasn't really, you know, I was really young. I was a teenager. I just stopped doing everything. I sort of stopped doing life. I had a lot of problems. I was really unhappy. My life was really a mess. I had loads of near-death experiences, you know, involving drugs before I came here. Some of them are actually accidental. Some of them weren't. So, I really thought, you know, that I was just going to carry on like that. I really wanted to just sort of go out in a big fiery ball. And then some, you know, I was just a teenager. That's, you know, what I wanted to do. I looked at, you know, sort of rock stars who died young, and I thought, yes, that's what I want. I want to do that as well. And I never really thought that much about it, but I just, you know, that made sense to me. That seemed to be the correct trajectory of my life at that time. And I can't explain what happened, but on March 23rd of 2000, the clouds just parted. I thought that there could be a better way to live. And I went to a meeting that day, actually. I had a very codependent mother who said, yes, you're going to a meeting right now, and got me to a meeting. And I already knew that I was meant to go to treatment. And so I went to my first meeting before I went to treatment. I went to treatment for 6 weeks and then several months after that. And so March 23rd is not my was my first clean date, May 21st of 2000, was when I got clean and decided to stay. I had to do a bit more research. I wasn't entirely sure. I thought that, you know, once I got the green one, and I thought that, you know, that's that was a sufficient amount of time to prove that I could do this, and, you know, therefore to reward myself, I was going to go back out again. I went out and got just horrifically drunk and drank myself to the point of alcohol poisoning, and then went back and got a white keyring the next day. I don't know. I don't have a lot to talk about with using. It's just, this is not, taking drugs doesn't seem like a good idea at the moment. It seems really, really boring. And whenever I encounter people who are talking about it and, you know, speak as though I'm missing out, I just sort of, I don't know. I don't know if it's just because I'm sort of old and curmudgeonly and I just want a quiet night in and, you know, I want to be weird and introverted privately in the privacy of my own home. or what the deal is. But it doesn't seem attractive any longer. It seems really, really terribly boring to have to listen to someone who's drunk or who's high carry on for any length of time. I just can't bear it. So just in trying to remember what my life was like before I came here, and just even what my life was like whilst I was here, and all of the stuff that I've been through. So I've come here, the sun is out, I feel so relaxed and groovy. I feel really happy, like an actual, real, genuine happiness, and I have this really lovely feeling. And I'm like, oh, I had to talk about all of the awful. Ooh. But you came here for the fireworks, so, you know, that's what you'll get. I don't know. I was just this really neurotic person who really thought that being depressed and all of that was really attractive. I thought that made better art and, you know, really wore all black. Oh, well, you know. Some things persist. But, I really had that as a part of my personality. I thought that was interesting. I thought that, you know, sort of, you know, being really attached to sort of this, please appreciate and respect my unhappiness. It is really real, and I don't want to be told to be grateful. You know, I had that sort of attitude through much of my early recovery, and, you know, that was sort of my personality. And now I just feel like, you know, sort of videos of baby pandas on YouTube, just sort of, you know, that's what life feels like for me at the moment. So I just have a difficult time accessing that sort of darkness that really was part of my, deeply embedded to my psyche for such a long time. But I don't know, I feel as though I should talk about what happened. So I left here, I was doing a service, I had a sponsor, had a sponsee, was involved in area level service, which I actually perversely really enjoyed. I really liked doing area level service. And I had a real sense of connection. I'm fairly certain that at my last chair I talked about my family and, feeling much of my story sort of being really disenfranchised from my family and not really feeling like I belong with them. You know, coming from this really, really nice family, but never really seeming to fall under the umbrella of that niceness. You know, having two brothers who are doctors, and, you know, I had basically a shaved head and, you know, and piercings in my face, and just wasn't really doing anything, and felt a deep and profound sense of shame about it all, and just really carried along, you know, this heavy burden of failing to measure up, and just really feeling that sense and feeling deeply rejected from my family, and having to learn how to forgive myself and forgive my my family and move forward with all of that. And so I was sharing about that quite a lot before I left for America, and then I went to America and was sort of immersed in my family of origin stuff because they all live there now. So, you know, my family lives in America, they moved there, and I grew up sort of alone with no other family members around. There were no other adult caregivers, there was no one to really look after me. My brothers are 7 and 14 years older than I am, and so they were gone away at school, and so I was really just on my own. I didn't really have a lot of play friends. I sort of lived, you know, there was just nobody else around. My parents weren't really interested in doing the parent thing, and when they were, it was sort of actually best to avoid them. So, and so, you know, I grew up thinking that I could never do anything, you know, that nothing I did was right, actually. So I grew up thinking, you know, when I got here, I really was deeply immersed in the story that I was just deeply and profoundly dysfunctional, and, you know, that I had all sorts of problems, and I was a troubled child, and, you know, all my family wanted to do was love me, and I just messed it up, you know, that sort of thing. And that really actually was not the truth. That's not my story. But that's, you know, that was the acceptable narrative, so I stuck with that, and that's sort of what I said for quite some time. So I went, after having lived here and sort of going back and seeing my family again, I really started to access a lot of stuff. I didn't have a nice time when I moved to America. You know, and my experience, I don't expect that many other people would have this, but I had a lot of life on life's terms that I hope that most people can't relate to. So I went there and I was going to a meeting like every day, and I sat down in a meeting and there was somebody there who I'd seen at two other meetings, and she shared about how she hated these bitches that come to the meetings with their Prada bags, driving their Audis, dressing like it's a fucking fashion show, and she just wants to kill them. And I looked around and I'm like, oh, she means me. That's oh dear. And it was just such a bizarre experience that she sat in the meeting and that was her share. You know, she said a lot more than that. She went on for about 8 minutes, but that's what I gathered. And everybody in the meeting sat and did nothing. Nobody stopped her. Nobody said anything. And so that happened straight after the gate after I moved there. And then loads of other stuff sort of like that happened. And it was just, it's not like how it is here. Nothing like that has ever happened to me here. Once someone shared back to me about how she said that, oh, I really wanted to hate you because of your accent, but you're just so weird and awkward, and I find it so endearing, so I forgive you. And that's the worst thing that ever happened to me in a meeting here. This is such a lovely fellowship, and people are really, it's a really strong fellowship. People are really supportive of one another, and you can see it. You can see that there are people with just loads of time that come to meetings and are active and sponsor people and do service. And, you know, I just wish that everybody knows how lucky they are, because where I was in meetings there, it's not like that. I often had the most time in the room. There are very few old-timers, and most of the people in the rooms had, you know, 2 years or under. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just not a strong fellowship. You know, here, nobody's on the phone. Nobody is doing any of that kind of stuff, and you can hear a pin drop, and that's not how meetings were where I was. It was really quite rough. And so, you know, I went to another meeting and somebody was, you know, doing the readings. So mind you, I was in a different country, and somebody did the readings in my accent, or their attempt to do that. And yeah, so, and then somebody else did the same thing with a different reading, and then he pulls out a knife. You know, just sort of sitting there with a knife saying, yeah, I double dare you. And, you know, the best I could do is just to sit and look nonplussed and, you know, not really care and be deeply disinterested. And I told somebody, at the break, you know, somebody actually had a weapon, and you do say at the beginning of the meetings not to bring any weapons to meetings. You do actually say that in the meetings here. And I think that was a weapon. And it turned into this big ordeal that I said something about it. And I told somebody else who had, you know, multiple years. And all of a sudden, I was absolutely hated for doing that and for saying, you know, you can't really do this in a meeting. And people in meetings there made my life really, really unpleasant. And not just in the space of meetings, but out in the world when they saw me. And as I said, nothing like that has ever happened here to I've never known anything like that to happen here, but that happened to me there, and talking about it to other people, and, you know, talking about it to people here, and just, you know, listening to people in deep disbelief, and telling other people in meetings there, and having, you know, people who weren't even in meetings say, no, that didn't happen, that person didn't mean that, well, you know, Second Amendment rights, you know, and stuff like that. And it was just really, really intense, and I was so unhappy, and was just sort of stuck and couldn't do anything about it. I felt like I had made this move to go there and was going to, you know, had a plan, and I went there to go to medical school so I could, you know, follow and, you know, be like my brothers and be socially acceptable and do all those sorts of things. And all of that didn't work out for me. It absolutely didn't work out for me. And I was in the midst of all of this stuff and all of this, like, really intense chaos. And, you know, I was there just before, you know, some major, major social problems started really happening there, and was living this and having that be my life and be my experience. So so that was really difficult. And, you know, I made a decision when this, you know, vaguely newcomer person did that at the meeting. You know, I decided, well, I've been around for a really long time, and I know that I can sort of weather this storm. Good luck to you people. You know, hope that you find some recovery, but I'm going to just find recovery in whatever way I can elsewhere. So, and it was really difficult to sort of make a decision to not go to meetings where people do that and don't realize that you can't, you know, really carry on like that in meetings. And, you know, and just talking to about other people, well, the only thing that you can do in this situation is just keep going to meetings. I'm like, not when people do that, actually. No. And so I had to be really creative, and I was really fortunate. I found meetings online, and there are some groups of people and meetings online who literally saved my life, because things got really difficult there. I mean, that's just sort of the beginning of the difficulties. Things got really, really difficult there, in just in how stuff happened. I mean, I didn't want to go into politics, but, you know, that sort of became a thing, and in really instructed people on what, you know, what was appropriate conduct and how to carry on, in, sadly, even in meeting spaces. So that was my life there for quite some time. And so I had, you know, I had a lot of negative experiences. Someone mugged me in front of my own house, and just all of these really sort of traumatic things started happening. It was difficult for me to make sense of it and to cope. I had a lot of attention for just sort of being different, for looking, you know, different than everybody else and speaking in a different way. And it was really overwhelming that I couldn't just sort of exist and be without having to explain myself to everyone. And, you know, even to be treated with sort of hostility and suspicion, which was really quite strange as well, that anybody actually cared about what I was doing at all. You know, I was there to study and to go to medical school. And it was just such a really bizarre time there, you know, preceding the election and all of that stuff. So all of that happened. Sadly, that's not the only time someone brandished a weapon at me. So a lot of that kind of stuff happened. I saw a lot of people and their guns, and, you know, and just in sort of threatening ways. And it was just really like, yep, there you are. There you are, waving a gun. So, I don't really want to be negative about that. It was just really what my experience was, and just feeling extremely traumatized and having a lot of, you know, getting a lot of negative attention from people, and not feeling like I was in a safe environment, and just feeling stuck, like I couldn't do anything about it. So, you know, I came back a few weeks ago, and I recommitted to the fellowship here, you know, and I realized how harmful it is for me to be away and to be disconnected from people who are supportive, and you know, that's the truth. Not, I mean, we're all sort of here for the same reason, but since I've been here, I've realized how wonderful and magical this fellowship is, and that people really are there and want to give numbers and want to have coffees and do all of this stuff. And you know, I remember being in America saying, will you please fellowship with me? Will you please, you know, be there? Will you please answer the phone? And I have, you know, when you reach out, you know, could the hand of NA please be there? And people just weren't really willing to do that. It was a really awful experience. And, you know, being here and having just this, just being overwhelmed with all of the love and all of the support that, you know to be here. It was just such a lovely feeling to be back. And, you know, it's just a really special fellowship. So I made notes because I forgot. I have to remind myself to talk about drugs. It's really your drugs, right? So, but I had such a different understanding of myself several years ago. I really was, you know, still, you know, just enveloped in shame. You know, I carried a lot of shame with me. I still felt a lot of shame for using and all of the mistakes that I had made. I really hadn't forgiven myself. I really hadn't gotten to that place. I still would think back to things that I'd done in the past and go, oh, God, you know, and just feel really awful about things. And, you know, I hadn't really forgiven myself for all of the mistakes that I had made and just really still carried this idea of myself as a person who was just a deeply flawed person who couldn't do anything right. You know, that made sense for me. I came here and I shared and it just felt wonderful to describe myself as an infectious human waste who couldn't do anything correct. And, you know, having this language that I was born with a disease and I just won't ever be able to sort of function and, you know, in a way, you know, that doesn't sort of attract, you know, negative attention or any, you know, I really, really carried that with me. And I really had just devastatingly low self-esteem, but hid beneath this intense, you know, bravado of something, I don't know. But it felt really oddly reassuring to sort of describe myself as this really negative person who does all these negative things and had all of this depression, anxiety, and, you know, and it was such a relief to know that I have a disease and that's why I have these problems. I really was seeking out that answer when I came to the doors of what, you know, what's wrong with me? And then I was met with people that told me, oh, you have the disease of addiction. Oh, this feels terrific. Thank you so much. Thank you. That's it. Wonderful. Good news. I really had that identity. I have a disease. I'm a disease person. That's it. I was born this way. I can't help it. This is who I am. And, you know, and just sort of went with that for quite some time. You know, this, I have a disease. Everything can be traced back to the disease of addiction that I have. I was born with it. Can't help it. You know, I was just born wrong. You know, I heard somebody share that at a meeting, and I thought, oh, I like that. I'm going to use that. I was born wrong. Yes. So, you know, and that felt really, really, you know, like the correct thing to say. I remember being a young person, so I grew up in a house with a medical textbooks, and I really liked reading them and reading about sort of abnormal psychology and reading all of the pathologists. Yes, I have that, I have that, I have that. Yes, that's what's wrong with me. And it was just really sort of a bizarre thing that I used to do. But, you know, in the time that I was in, you know, that I was abroad and sort of had retreated from meetings and just sort of had nothing to do but to sit and meditate, something extraordinary happened. I sort of went really, you know, deep inside of myself and sort of accessed all the darker aspects of my shadow self and really got to the truth of things. And I asked, you know, I did something that I hadn't really thought to do because I forgot about the person that I was before I came here, before anything, you know, who was this person I actually am? I asked to see some photos of myself from when I was a child and when I was an infant. You know, who is this person? Can I see the disease of addiction in this 2-year-old girl? Is it there? And I had to remember the story of my life. Who am I really? Because I, you know, I've been handed a script. What is the script that I've been carrying? I'm an addict, so I was born this way. Is that correct? That seems like it. That's what I've been saying for quite a long time. Seems correct. That's what other people around me say, so we'll go with that. But the truth is that You know, I was not born a flawed person. I was born somebody who was bright and talented and confident, who learned that I was flawed. That's the truth. I'm not really interested in diverting from that. It felt really comfortable to say, well, yes, I was born wrong and I just do things that way. You know, it felt correct to say that, but the truth is not that. I was born a wonderful, bright, talented person who was very, very capable. I don't want to sort of go into all of the everything because it seems like ego, but I had to remind myself of this when I was really in a dark, lonely place. I taught myself to read and write when I was 2 years old. Do you know what I mean? I could do my elder brother's algebra when I was like four. That's who I am. Really, that's who I am. And somehow, somewhere along the line, I was told that I was this rotten child that couldn't do anything properly. And, you know, everything I did was wrong. I never met the mark. I never measured up, you know. And I carried that. I carried that with me and thought that that's the person that I am. That's not the person that I am. You know, I was a pretty brilliant, determined child who had things to do and was told otherwise. And the latter part of that statement was completely beyond my control. I had no choice in that matter. I had no choice in the circumstances that I was born in. So, you know, I grew up with people who dressed me down regularly, despite all of my talents and despite all of this, you know, all these innately wonderful things about me. That's what I got in return for that. And that's who I thought that I was. And when I arrived here, that's who I still thought that I was. And I had to unlearn all of that. So in this time that was really dark and deeply unpleasant, where I was extremely alone and isolated and didn't even feel as though I could so much as go to a meeting, this is what I discovered about myself, that this is who I am, that I am not a flawed, you know, morally bankrupt person who was just, you know, born with a disease. I was a person who was bright and talented, who learned the script in life that I was handed and said the lines. That's what I learned. And I've really fought very, very hard to unlearn all of this negative sort of programming that I got and become the person that I actually am. And to not carry around that shame and to forgive myself for my mistakes and to forgive myself for, you know, forgive the people around me for their mistakes and to recognize that. And once I was really actually able to look at my own darkness and see the person that I am and see how that happened, I could sit back and look at other people, and I sort of just sorted out my family. I sorted out where all of the rejection comes from. Because I, you know, part of my story, and I used to share that all the time, is how deeply rejected I was from my family, and particularly my brothers, and what a difficult time I had. And, you know, I had, practically everyone that knows me knows that I've had such a tenuous relationship with my eldest brother, but he's 14 years older than me and was just so harsh and critical, like, you know, almost like an abusive parent to me. And, you know, I sat back one day and I realized that this person knows that he has the same parents that I have, actually. He knows that he has the same parents that I have. He knows that when his mother, our mother, found him, you know, when he was 2 years old, holding my father's gun. He knows that that's who his parents are as well, and he has been awful to me because he knows that when he went away, he essentially, you know, he has to be angry with me to overcome the cognitive dissonance that he has left me to die with these people who have been so deeply abusive to him and then to me. That's where all of that stuff comes from. And I've learned a lot of that. You know, I've learned to forgive myself for a lot of these things and forgive other people for their stuff as well. So, you know, having, you know, accessed all of these things and all of these really dark, dark memories and thinking to myself, well, actually, I wasn't a depressed person. Actually, I was doing the best that I could in a really unpleasant circumstance. Actually, I fell off of a boat, or my father caused me to fall off of a boat when I was 12 years old, a mile and a half out at sea, and my parents don't really do that sort of helicopter parenting with, you know, flotation devices and all of that. And I had no other choice. A mile mile and a half out in open water, but to swim to shore. And that's what I did when I was 12 years old. There was nobody to tell me there's nothing wrong with you, you know, that you've had some really awful experiences and you're trying to do whatever you can to cope with it, to survive, to overcome this intense trauma that you've had. There's no one to do that. There's no one, only people to say you have mental health issues and you're awful and we're going to load you up with antidepressants and mood stabilizers and tell you that you have loads of problems that you don't have. That's, you know, those are the people around me. There's no one to say, no, you are not at fault, actually, you know. And there's no one to say the reason that you are taking drugs is to overcome the intense pain of life and to survive. And this is the only way your mind knows how to do that. You know, and that's the sort of dissenting remark there, but that's the truth of my life. That's how I found drugs. And when I found them, I felt fantastic. And, you know, it didn't occur to me that that's why, what led me down that path, that I had to do that to ease the pain of living, because otherwise it was just too difficult and too painful. I had to be 12 years clean before I was able to connect those dots and to say that, and to not be afraid to say that to other people. It was really easy when I got here to say, yes, I'm an addict, yes, I'm an addict, yes, I did all of these things. It was much more difficult to say, I did all of these things because of the circumstances that I was born into, and this is what I had to do to survive. And all of these weird, bizarre things that I haven't been able to explain did this to protect whatever is inside of me so that I don't just absolutely implode and kill myself. This is what I have to do to survive until I realize that there was another way, and that's this way, you know. So I'm very, very fortunate that I was able to find this, and to know that there was another way in order for me to just carry on and to do life. Very, very grateful for that. I've had loads, I mean, I think I just said a moment ago that somebody pulled a knife on me in a meeting. But, you know, despite all of that, you know, I see that and I say, well, there's a person that's in a lot of pain and doesn't really understand not to do that. But, you know, whatever, I'm still going to be here. Yeah, I still get to be here, actually. This is where I want to be. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fine. Just not going to go to that meeting. So... maybe not any meeting, you know. So I went through all of these emotions. I felt really angry. I felt really angry with the program, but I thought this group of people is not NA. This group of people is not the program. This group of people is, you know, not the steps. You know, it's really actually not the steps. And so, it's my responsibility to look after myself and to do what's best for me, you know. It's not what's best for me is to keep doing the same thing and expecting different results and expecting other people are going to behave the way they want them to. So I need to look after myself and get myself home, actually. I need to get myself to meetings where people don't do that and actually, you know, if you like me, and if they don't like me, at least they can ignore me. So, so what a luxury. So I don't know. I can't believe that 40 minutes have passed already. I don't even know how that happened. So I'm not going to be that person that holds the meeting hostage, but I have such an immense sense of gratitude. I haven't even gotten into all of the, you know, everything.
All the good stuff.
I haven't even gotten to the acrobatic routine. Shoot. But no, it's just, I'm filled with such immense gratitude, and it's so lovely to be here and to be sharing in a meeting in London. It feels like a major vote of confidence that somebody asked me to do the share. So it feels just so nice to be here. It feels nice to be in rooms where people are, you know, just want to be here. So if you're new, Keep coming back. If someone takes out a knife, go to a different meeting. I don't think that really happens, but you know. But no, you're absolutely in the right place. And if no one else has told you, you're absolutely in the right place here. Your addiction is not your fault. You deserve to be here. You've earned your seat. Please keep coming back. There's a better way. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.